Thank you very much for the kind invitation to speak with you. I guess my membership finally paid off. In Canada, the invitation to speak on a Saturday afternoon in May is viewed with some trepidation because one is at risk of a beautiful, sunny, warm day where people would rather be off doing something else. That's not a problem with which the English have to be concerned. So I readily accepted the invitation. I defend people that are charged with crimes. I enjoy it very, very much. It's a lot of pressure, but it's enormous great fun, and I have to admit that I quite enjoy going to court and asking questions and allowing people to expose themselves in the courtroom. Sometimes they're charged with exposing themselves outside the courtroom. So, and you know, I loved, one of the reasons I loved it is because most of our clients are guilty, you know that. And so they come in and we talk and I make them many pounds lighter or dollars lighter, whatever the currency is. And they say, do the best you can for me, I'm guilty. And we have an understanding. If we win the case, it's because of my skill. If we lose the case, it's because they messed up. But in the late 80s, early 90s, I started to see a new kind of client, and I started to get very upset. And the kind of client I started to see was really the sort of people I see in this room. And the demographics are astoundingly striking. Wherever I go to speak about false memory syndrome, the demographics are astonishing. They are generally white, upper class, middle class people, very few visible minorities, very few other religious groups. Certainly in North America, false memory is a illness that strikes the most privileged group of children imaginable. I mean, it is an astounding phenomenon. But anyways, I started to see this, and unlike normal clients, the accused in these cases would be fantastic people. They'd even be people I'd go to dinner with, and I do not socialize with clients, no matter how of what station. But these were people that could be my friends, and astonishingly, they were always innocent. But not just said they were innocent, they were objectively innocent. There was never any evidence of guilt, except in words. So what was I to make of this? Well, fortunately, I knew what to make of this. I was quite prepared. I was sorry, but I was quite prepared. And the reason I was quite prepared was that for many years, I had belonged to skeptics organizations. I had belonged to groups that did magic. In other words, groups that know that things are not what may not be what they seem to be. Groups that are very familiar with human suggestibility. Groups that know that there is nothing too stupid to attract a sizable following. That we know that from history. There is no idea so preposterous that someone will not found a journal, develop a substantial subscription list, and make a lot of money out of it. So, and ironically, shortly before my first case, I had been at a skeptics conference where I had listened to John Mack talk about alien abductions, and I had spent considerable time with the woman that had infiltrated his group and exposed him. So I realized that this was now, for the first time, a kind of criminal case of that genre. And contrary to what Chris said in his excellent presentation, my bad news to you is the iceberg is much, much larger than even Chris described. This is not the tip of an iceberg about medicine. It's not the tip of an iceberg about malpractice. It's the tip of an iceberg about scientific illiteracy. We live in a world where the majority of people have neither the ability nor the inclination to want to know what is true. We live in a world, I'm sorry to tell you this, and you contribute to it, because it's all on a continuum. When you buy a lottery ticket, when you phone the psychic hotline, you are contributing to a world in which the boundary between imagination and reality is being distorted. My 9-year-old phoned the psychic hotline as a joke. And when the psychic asked, "What do you want to know?" my 9-year-old said, "Well, if you were a psychic, you'd know that, wouldn't you?" And hung up and was killing herself laughing. I started with false memory cases in a case that's been given the pseudonym of Adams and was written up in an article that Cam Perry of Concordia University wrote in the Journal Psychiatry, Psychology and the Law, Volume 2 for November 1995, and he was kind enough to list me as a co-author. And as someone once said, once I got into this business, they said, "You know, Alan, you were really lucky that your first case was a textbook case of false memory syndrome." And I said, "Well, as Napoleon used to say, send me lucky generals. Yes, absolutely, it is good to be lucky. But on the other hand, I like to think that I had something to do with making it a textbook case." So Mr. Adams was an insurance broker, a wonderful person who died, unfortunately, from cancer some years later, who had a son who had won an Olympic medal and who had two other children who had gone completely off the rails. And this man wound up sitting in jail for 2 weeks being denied bail because the one son and daughter had accused him of childhood sexual abuse. And as he loved to tell it, he whiled away his days playing cards with the deputy commander of the Hells Angels motorcycle gang, and they got on very well. But he was in jail because his first lawyer, who I happen to know, knew nothing about false memory syndrome. And therefore, at the bail hearing, treated it as if these allegations should be had some weight. Well, we got him out on bail, and we prepared the case. And you can read about it in here, but there were three complainants, the daughter, the son, and the daughter's daughter also said, "Granddaddy started fondling me," okay? We had a preliminary hearing, and normally at a preliminary hearing, you don't try to get the case thrown out because it's such a low burden. Well, I felt so bad for these people that I went for broke at the preliminary hearing. And after the cross-examination of the witnesses, and the Crown did not dare call the therapist because I would have just, I just enjoy cross-examining a lot, okay? The judge concluded the 17-month process of recovering memories was one of unrelenting suggestion. The witnesses were not credible. The son's evidence was adjudged to be outlandish from the start and the product of near or complete insanity. The granddaughter's evidence, and remember, it's hard to cross-examine a 9-year-old child. Okay, you have to be very careful how you do it. The judge's conclusion on the granddaughter's evidence was characterized as among the least reliable I have ever seen in a child, and in my view, it is nothing but an effort to please her mother. The judge's reasons concluded that if he could stop the case, he would. But unfortunately, under the law, he's got to send the case for trial, but he hoped that the prosecutor would have the good sense to stop the case, and then a month later the prosecutor took one look at it and stopped the case. That case involved therapy. She couldn't recover memories. She couldn't recover memories. When she finally started to recover memories, they had a party. They had a memory party to celebrate the first memories. And they invited the grand. I know it. You wonder how anyone could treat this seriously, okay? But the therapy records were delightful and it was all there. So that was my first. Since then, I've had perhaps a dozen. None have ended in convictions. Some have been withdrawn once I get involved. Complainants don't like me to cross-examine them. I don't know why. I'm very nice. I will never say a harsh word to a witness. One was the chief of police of a town near Toronto, accused by his daughter. That went to a jury trial, and I'll come back to that case because it deals with some of the English problems. At that trial, the daughter, of course, told of a nightmarish childhood. And one of the things you learn from these cases is that no memory is reliable. You have to remember that. Memories about memories are unreliable. They're still memories. So if someone tells you how long they remember something, that's not reliable. But also, good people's memories are unreliable. One of the things you have to do in these cases is gather up all available information. Unfortunately, we live in an age of videotape, so that most family functions are now videotaped. I always ask for all the videotapes. I ask for videotape of a wedding at which my client had remarried, and the client didn't think there was anything significant on it. I watched the videotape, and on it, the complainant, and this is a year before she recovers the memory, is reciting to her dad the poem, "How Do I Love Thee, Let Me Count the Ways." Well, when the jury saw that, most defense lawyers have a tremendous love for human liberties. We're constantly defending them, and we're known for that. But what defense lawyers don't realize is that human liberties and scientific liberties grew out of exactly the same nest, the Enlightenment. Most of the famous cases in science, Galileo, the Star Chamber, they were not just about human civil liberties, they were also about scientific liberties, the ability to investigate and to think things that the church didn't like. Remember, Galileo is a very famous case. All Galileo, I don't know whether this is just the play or whatever, but remember, I always like to recite to judges Galileo's famous line when he was put on trial for heresy, because he had looked through the telescope. He kept saying to his accusers, just look through the telescope, for God's sakes, look through the telescope. And of course, their position was, we don't have to look. We know what truth is because the church has told us. And I always remember that line. So I say to judges, just look through the telescope. So the two are interrelated. So you can't love human liberty without having a love of science and the idea that there's a reality out there that I love to call Mother Nature, because it's kind of a little bit of a turn on that you're fiddling around with a female out there, but you're trying to find out her secrets. She doesn't care what you want the truth to be. She couldn't care less. She has her truth. And as someone once said, she will only give you a lift if you're going her way. If you want to believe dumb things, if you're not going to investigate and research, she couldn't care less. She's just standing there laughing at you. So those two ideas are very much intertwined in human development. Scientific liberty, you know, 1984 is a story about a repressive society. Right? We forget that one of the key elements of the 1984 society was that they controlled science. They claimed that they could levitate. They just didn't do it because they didn't want to. But remember, the Orwellian society controlled science. Every evil society has to control science, because if you let people do the research they want, you're in trouble sooner or later. So when I got involved in false memory cases, I did all this research, it made me a better lawyer, helped me win cases, that's what we want to do, people like to pay you more if you win cases. But I then shared the knowledge, because people shared the knowledge with me. I got involved early on with the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, and it was a godsend, because one of the things you have to do whenever you're fighting this kind of evil is you've got to collect and store and disseminate information. Yet each person cannot rediscover the wheel. It's hard to win cases if you go back to square one in each case. The False Memory Syndrome Foundation did a magnificent job of collecting all the available science, storing it, and disseminating it as needed so that lawyers and judges and scientists could become better educated in a very fast, steep learning curve. Did a fantastic job, and I always thank them whenever I speak. So fantastic, I now have 30 bankers' boxes of materials and articles devoted to nothing but this issue, which you can have back anytime you want, by the way. And I got into the larger issue of junk science in the courtroom. But then what I did was I realized, you know, it's easy to win, for me to win these cases. And like Chris says, the courtroom, what we call the one-man lobby, it's a wonderful place because these quacks can't avoid the truth. I get to ask the questions. They have to play according to my rules. So one-on-one in a courtroom, recovered memory always loses. But, so I win one case, I win two cases, even nine cases. What have I done? So that was enough. So what I did, because I'm well known in Canada, for some reason, what I said about nothing's too silly to get believed, some people think I'm accomplished. So I organized three conferences, one a year for 3 years, under the group that I had some membership in, Criminal Lawyers Association. And in 1993, 94, 95, it was like Star Wars. I wanted to have a three-year sequence of conferences. And I would phone up the leading experts in North America, including Steve Cici. I got to know Beth Loftus, Maggie Brooke from McGill. One of the experts was in our own backyard. Bella DiPaolo on detection of deception. I just knew these people from the literature. And I phoned them up and I said, now look, our courts are having a real problem. Because these quacks are coming in and giving our judges total nonsense. And I told them what I always say about judges. You know, you can lead a judge to logic, but you can't make them think. I said, you know, it's not enough for me to just say, look, judge, 2 + 2 = 4, right? It doesn't equal 6 or 8 like this quack is telling you. I shamed them. I said, you have to contribute because otherwise you're not a legitimate expert. You know the truth. You have to share it. Going to court shares it one-on-one with the judge. That's not good enough. Come to my conferences and you'll share it with 200 judges and 300 lawyers. And they did. And they were fantastic. At no fee, just for expenses, for 3 years we traipsed through Toronto. Virtually every leading expert on memory, child interviewing, on children, we did. We put together a set of, and these are all on videos, by the way. You're welcome to borrow copies of them anytime you want. We put together model cross-examinations, different styles of cross-examining complainants, experts, and. That there was a very and we attracted people from all across Canada because we're like the major province, major organization. And so in Canada we had a very, very fast education for everybody of what the problem was about. And we were very, very proud that we had done that. A lot of judges, you know, because if you lose as many cases as I do, judges start being nice to you and coming up to you. And so I know most of the judges, and invariably they'd come up and say, geez, you know, I never knew that. I mean, no one ever told me that this was the truth before. You know why? Because junk science has an inherent built-in advantage. You know the Chinese proverb that a lie is halfway around the world while truth is still getting its shoes on? Do you know that? It's true. Junk science, there's a selection bias. This is why you should always be skeptical of so-called new discoveries. Because of the built-in selection bias, the odds are that any new discovery will be bogus. Why? Because new discoveries, if they're bogus, the people think in bogus fashion, which means they don't prepare properly, they don't double-check, they rush to disclose their new discovery, like the cold fusion fiasco. So, but on the other hand, if you're a serious scientific researcher, you're going to be cautious. You're going to want to replicate. You're going to want to think about it. You're going to want to make sure you're not missing something. So that in announcements, there is a selection bias in favor of junk science. Of the perhaps 200 developments in criminal justice in this century that were heralded as great discoveries, fingerprints and DNA. You know, there's literally a handful that really were great discoveries. People forget about all the other great discoveries that have disappeared in the pile of junk science. Voice prints and all kinds of other stuff. Okay? So remember that. Whenever you hear of some new startling breakthrough, if you're just a betting person, you can bet it's probably junk, just on a statistical basis. So once we held these conferences, and they were very, very well attended, we had over 1,500 people, over 500 a year, which is, for Canada, is very large. You know, we're not that, and also there were sunny days. Then I, once you develop a reputation for this, then people want to hear you speak. I suspect it's because the preferred speakers were unavailable or whatever. Next thing I know, I'm lecturing on this to judges. I have probably lectured to every judge in Canada at one function or another. The month before I came here, I was at the appellate court judges in Halifax talking about expert evidence. The afternoon that I left, I went to the airport from an afternoon conference on expert evidence to our superior court judges. There was about 300 of them just from our province. Recently, I went out west to do one for our provincial court judges, and they just published it in their journal. And the editor, the judge who was the editor, quoted what I think is, and this is the message that I always tell our judges, that junk science, self-delusional clinical experience, opinions derived from bad data or faulty logic, all lack real probative value and constitute in a real sense a fraud on the court. It is forensic snake oil that can lead to miscarriages of justice or at the least bring the administration of justice into disrepute by demonstrating an embarrassing gullibility. And then the editor went on to say, there's much more of the same to be had from this reading. I saw Alan Gold in full flight when he was presenting his paper. It was clear to me that this subject excites him. I didn't show that to my wife. So, the word has been spread far and wide in Canada. We certainly do have little intellectual backwaters that publish pamphlets about their two memory systems and implicit memory, and you see the same little cadre of names appear constantly. They're so incestuous. They cite each other's articles. No one else will. So we still have that, but they're isolated, and we have a very good network of false memory groups in Canada that take, and this is very, very important. Remember, every little bit helps. They, every time they see some nonsense, they do something about it. They write a letter, they complain to the people that are paying the bills. It's very, very important, because each of these little groups of nonsense is like a spark that could start something again. So our people in Canada, who are a tremendously devoted set of volunteers that you would do well to emulate, whenever you see a piece, whenever you see a university sex abuse clinic uttering a piece of nonsense, you write to the university and complain about it, along with references, so that you try and isolate these silly people more and more. Now, as I say, my interest is broader than this. So, I mean, when I see this about a homeopathy or whatever, you know, we try and do the same thing. This is part of a general problem of scientific illiteracy. Recently, one of our major universities agreed to, for the first time in North America, to found a college of chiropractic. And I wrote them and told them I won't give any speeches or lectures at that university, at their law school. I won't have anything to do with them. And I'm thinking of resigning from a board that I sit on having to do with the Institute for the Study of Organized Crime, because the whole thing was a sham. I mean, chiropractic gave them a check for $10 million. I said, I look forward to the opening of the Academy of Astrology and the School of Scientology. You know, so you do have to take a stand against this kind of nonsense, of which recovered memory therapy is simply one illustration. In terms of the law in Canada, it hasn't gone as far as the States. I wish it had. As far as I know, I'm the only lawyer that has tried to argue that the evidence is inadmissible. And this was the point that the British barrister was making earlier, that generally the English view is that these things go to the weight of the evidence. But I have found it effective to argue that the judge should hold a hearing whether to even admit recovered memory evidence, because what generally happens is you have such a good time at the voir dire, that even if the judge sort of holds his nose and admits the evidence, you've generally scared off the crown, or at least scare them off from calling their expert. or at least scare them off from calling the therapist. And of course, the first thing the jury notices is the therapist isn't there, and they generally acquit on that basis alone. So under English law, certainly under Canadian law, there is nothing to prevent you from arguing its admissibility. The analogy I use is this. I say that, that I acknowledge that memory is the currency of the courts. It's what the courts deal in. But false memory is counterfeit currency and therefore should not even be admitted. And I use the American cases to try to support this proposition. And as I say, the case, the two where it's reached that stage, the judge has said it's admissible, but boy, this is really awful, and it sort of knocked some sense into the prosecutor. So the present state of the Canadian law, there have been a number of recovered memory cases, all ending in acquittals. The present state of the Canadian law is essentially that the evidence is so bad that you shouldn't convict upon it unless there was some really strong independent evidence. And as a result, no one has been convicted in a false memory case in Canada in the last several years that I'm aware of. The convictions were earlier on, before people were educated as to how to defend these cases. But there hasn't been a conviction in the recent past, and the number of cases seems to be dropping dramatically. So that maybe this particular form of nonsense is on the way out. However, one never knows. Anytime you're charged, you're at risk of being convicted. And so it's always a very dangerous thing to do. We have lobbied the government to try to put an end to these cases and sort of gotten a milquetoast response back. I wrote a letter to the Minister of Justice, which was signed by over 100 academics and scientists and other people, psychologists, psychiatrists, urging her not to allow recovered memory cases and to conduct an investigation into people that may be in prison because of recovered memory cases. Her response was, we haven't had any applications from people claiming to be wrongly convicted, and so there's no need to do anything. We have tried, there is research going on in false memory cases in Canada. We have tried to locate people that have been convicted. We're having a hard time doing so because, of course, you run into this problem that there are some guilty people who will try and shelter behind this rubric. And so one has to be very careful to maintain one's credibility. The other problem is this, that it's not like murder cases, that in Canada, sentences tend to be relatively short. So that if you were convicted in 89 or 90 or 91 or 92, you would probably get a sentence of perhaps 4 to 7 years maximum. Our people are generally paroled after a third, so the chances of finding anyone still in jail in one of these old cases is next to nil. That doesn't mean there weren't miscarriages of justice. It just means they're not serious enough to these people that they wish to do something about them now. So that's the general situation. Our courts have reacted quite well to this education. I think it's been as fast as one can possibly expect in any country. And it may be because we have a very high level of communication between the Ontario Bar and the rest of the country. We're very, very well networked as lawyers. I became president of the Criminal Lawyers Association. And so I talk to people constantly. Very good communication with the bench. And as a result, they're very interested in what we have to say. And so in general, there's a high level of interest. And in a particular case, properly resourced, properly defended, it's pretty easy to expose these bogus experts. So what are the lessons? Because I want to leave time for questions. Unfortunately, I can't stay as late today as I would have liked, so I want to give you some time to ask questions in case you can't ask me later. I guess one of my proudest accomplishments was our campaign reached the point where one of our provincial attorneys general, which is the highest law officer said that he spoke up and said that he encouraged the government to provide information on recovered memory opinions to convicts who may have been judged on recovered memory evidence so that they can press for a review. And he's the Attorney General of British Columbia, which is a hotbed of nonsensical therapeutic practice in Canada. It's our California. It's just up the coast from California, and the hot air rises, I guess. So what are the lessons we can learn from this whole thing? Because this has been, for me, I know this is going to sound cruel, okay, but I can't help it. For me, it has been a fantastic experience in both the power and weakness of human intellect. You know, if you know anything about history, which as far as I'm concerned, all the answers are there. I mean, we do not come up with anything new. We just come up with different labels. But everything we do stupid has been done before. If you look in the history of medicine, I mean, the museum of nonsense in medicine, not just psychiatry, it's amazing, you know, examples that we give, you know, like childbed fever, women dying from having children because doctors would do autopsies and go deliver babies without washing their hands. And, you know, the guy that said, geez, maybe there's something on the hands that's causing this was laughed at and ridiculed till he washed his hands and his death rate dropped. And it still took time to convince people that maybe should wash their hands. Schizophrenia, you forget that schizophrenia was due to bad mothering for how many decades? Okay, I always believed that the real psychiatric problems would turn out to be organic medical problems, and the rest was simply how people chose to live their lives. Other examples, when I grew up, ulcers. My mother used to tell me, don't worry, you'll get an ulcer. If you look at the history of stress, you will see there's a list of 10 diseases that were supposed to be caused by stress. Three are now clearly known to be organic. There's nothing stressful about ulcers. They're caused by some little bug, that's a technical term, in your stomach. And that was proved by a guy who swallowed the bug and got an ulcer. Because again, the people around him wouldn't contemplate the hypothesis that ulcers were caused by anything other than stress. So why the medical profession doesn't become scientific after all these sorry lessons, I don't know. But in any event, what lessons do we learn from this sad episode, which is one in a million sorry episodes in human history? First of all, knowledge is power. A little knowledge may be a dangerous thing, but sometimes what is dangerous too is ignorance. False memory syndrome collected the knowledge, stored it, disseminated it. It was a powerful, it was like a vaccine. It was a powerful inoculant against the nonsense that was spreading. It's an amazing, and I wait for the book to be written. I think the False Memory Syndrome Foundation is an amazing case study in sort of lobbying, in the good sense, by ordinary people against a tremendous social problem. I mean, stop and think about what was accomplished in such a relatively short period of time. Now, I have to tell you, there's, I think, a rather unfortunate footnote to that. Remember what I told you about the demographics? You know, you could say that one of the reasons for its success, and I suspect Pamela would probably acknowledge this, is, well, sure, the problems of the middle and upper class get better attended to. If false memory syndrome had been a problem of the poor, who knows what, I mean, that's a legitimate point to be made about all this, okay? But the fact is that, yes, people with resources get better lives. There's no way, that's one of Mother Nature's idiosyncrasies, and there's no way to change it. The world is a jungle, it's not a daycare center. But so knowledge is power. Although the therapist would like to turn it into a daycare center. Don't hit him, don't hit him, don't talk nasty to each other. So knowledge is power, collecting the information. Any group such as yourself that shares a common problem, you're going to be much farther ahead if you develop a collective memory, a collective knowledge base. We as lawyers, I always collect transcripts. I share them with other lawyers for the cost of photocopying. Because these quacks can never say the same thing twice, because they're just making it up as they go along. So, I mean, we have transcripts of them saying exact opposites in two different cases. Do you know how devastating that is? So the Crown experts, we would focus in on them, collect all their transcripts, share them among the lawyers. Next thing you know, they're not testifying as experts anymore. One woman testified as an expert witness in Ottawa 13 times before she finally ran into a defense lawyer that knew what he was doing. And this guy really knew what he was doing. He had her on the witness stand for 3 days, at the end of which the most Crown-oriented judge in the city said she wasn't an expert witness after she had been declared an expert 13 times. And this judge said, this lawyer did such a magnificent job on this voir dire, that's the hearing as to whether someone should be allowed to testify. When I started, I would have said she's an expert without any, this is what she said to me privately afterwards, because I'd always commend this lawyer's job in that case. She said, I would have thought, of course she's an expert, but after 3 days, I realized this was all nonsense, and that expert then closed their practice and left town. I don't know where they are now. So knowledge is power. Secondly, the whole episode is a virtual case study in the necessity for scientific literacy. There are going to be other episodes of foolishness. There will be, as long as there's money to be made. And also, there's a good argument to be made that we're designed to think foolishly. Our brains are designed, it's not a malfunction. Okay, from an evolutionary point of view, maybe the best way to be is to jump to conclusions, to see relationships where there are none. Maybe from an evolutionary point of view, that's how a brain is best designed. It doesn't, maybe logic, in other words, is counterintuitive. There's nothing hard about logic. You can learn it easily. I find it extremely empowering. I love pointing out to people that, gee, maybe they should think about something a little bit more. I find it empowering that I'm not worried about being fleeced or taken advantage of. Some people don't. Maybe aren't controlling their brains. But scientific literacy is a real problem. So if you believe in human liberty, you got to try and free your brain and learn to think logically, so that when you read in the newspaper, and my kids do this now instinctively, you read in the newspaper that somebody's done a survey, that you should always look where the exits are in an airplane, because 95% of people that survived airplane crashes did that. Instinctively, you say to yourself, excuse me, where's the control group? You can't interview the people that didn't survive airplane crashes. How do you know that 96% of them didn't examine their exits, in which case you shouldn't do it because it appears to contribute to your death? Now, that's just a simple example, but I've got to tell you, if you want to be safe, you've got to reach the point when you read one of those little articles, you instinctively form a control group. You instinctively say to yourself, you know, an editor with a brain wouldn't bother publishing this except as a joke. The examples aren't going. Let me give you an example, and this is a real example. I predict within 5 years, and it's going to be in England, because I think even the New Scientist had an item on this recently. Within 5 years, you're going to have an expert come into court and tell you that they have discovered a hormonal marker for child abuse. What he's going to tell you is that because of the level of this hormone, the name of which I forget, but some of you may know, that this child was intentionally abused. It wasn't an accidental physical injury. Now, how do they reach this amazing ability to decide that someone intentionally beat a child from a hormone? Well, what they found is that once there's an injury, the level of this hormone in the spinal fluid rises. And the theory is that people that accidentally injure their children take them to the hospital faster, whereas if you intentionally injure your child, you procrastinate. So that this hormone is a marker, because as it rises, it shows how much time has elapsed since the injury. Therefore, if it's above a certain level, this child was intentionally injured. You're going to get that kind of expert evidence. What I say to judges when I give them that is, I hope you'll be ready to assess that kind of evidence. I hope you'll be ready to ask things like, first and foremost, who did the research? Was it some research group investigating something about the hormone? Or was it some well-intentioned, bleeding heart, child abuse expert who is determined to discover the silver bullet for child abuse, who just knows there's an easy answer, and if they discover it, they will become famous, etc., etc., etc.? In other words, what was the nature of the research out of which this research grew? If it was the former, you might pay some attention to it. If it was the latter, throw it out. That is such a corrupting environment for any research to grow out of that the chances of it being valid are virtually nil. But fine, you can examine it. But then judges and lawyers should be able to then ask all the right questions. You know, what's the number of cases? What are the controls? How are the measurements done? What are the margins of error? Etc., etc., etc. There will always be new expert evidence for which fantastic claims will be made. Scientific literacy is going to become a greater problem, not a smaller one. EMDR, you know, the with the eyeballs, you've all heard of that. You know, last month, I couldn't believe it, in the FBI magazine. See, you have to read all this stuff to know what's going on around it. In the FBI magazine, there an article about how they treat the stress of their agents after their field work. I guess after they show Monica in and out of the White House, they're stressed out. In the FBI magazine, it said as one of their treatments, they use EMDR. I couldn't believe it. So because I publish a lot, I write a little note about this, sort of poking fun at the FBI, just so that, you know, you try and inoculate people against this. Touch therapy. This is becoming, you know, you wave your hand around, and it would be okay if like a coin or a card appeared, it'd be interesting, but nothing ever happens. They just wave their hand around, that's it. So it's even bad magic. Eating disorders and child abuse. You know, how many times are we going to have to say that one has nothing to do with the other? Whenever someone says that, to me, it's another, you know, childbirth disorder. It's another ulcers caused by stress. I mean, it's going to go down in medical history as another laughing stock. Someone's shaking their head here, so I've obviously better leave that right away. Okay. Knowledgeable defense lawyers. Okay, this is another lesson that comes out of this, and I guess prosecutors as well. I'm sorry, defense lawyers are a subgroup of the human species, although there's some debate about that, I guess, but let's assume that that's true. The average lawyer is no better or worse than the public at large. The public at large is scientifically illiterate. The scientific illiteracy of lawyers has been well known for years. And people have said, the problem is law is not a scientific culture, it's a literary culture. So making lawyers scientifically literate is a real issue. In the United States, I love the cases that Chris talked to you about. They brought matters to a head. They said, the scientific method is part and parcel of our justice system. So all the lawyers, all the judges rushed out to become scientifically literate. They've had fantastic training programs. The Federal Judicial Institute has published a 530-page manual, which is available for free on the internet, which applies the scientific method to a variety of different contexts. It doesn't tell judges the answers, but it tells them how to ask the questions. A great piece of work. So because of these two decisions in the States, scientific literacy has become very important in the United States, and I keep trying to import it into Canada. Our Supreme Court gives a decision on expert evidence, and I'd give it about a C+ compared to the American decisions, and I openly admit I keep fudging it to try to make it more like the American decisions. So knowledgeable, scientifically literate members of the bar and the bench is an object lesson. This whole thing would have ended sooner if we'd had that. Part of what contributed to its end is the fact that we were educated quickly. Proper preparation of the defense. Criminal cases, I'm sure in this country as well as others, they're privately funded. If they're publicly funded, shortcuts are taken. I don't know what the legal aid scheme is in England. In Ontario, we have one of the best legal aid plans in the world, and I would not want to be defended on legal aid, quite frankly, unless I had a very keen, idealistic lawyer who was willing to work a lot for nothing. I don't know any way to solve that problem, except what we do as an institution and the Criminal Lawyers Association is we try and help people with the information, with the resources. In other words, that's one way to solve that problem. But other than that, I'm sorry. Life is unfair. And if you're in a terrible car accident and you're under-resourced, maybe you won't do as well as the person who's better resourced. Well, sometimes being charged, especially if you're innocent, is like being involved in a terrible accident. School records, photographs, family albums, there's nothing that I don't want to look at, because it's amazing how often you find the little details that completely put the lie to the complainant's story. Building records, when rooms were built, when rooms were added, when the garage was built. Okay, I'm almost done. So in Canada, the early cases ended in convictions that would have been acquittals in the later age, and it's pretty hard today to get convicted in a false memory case unless you have a really bad lawyer who doesn't prepare properly, and of course we hope that will never happen. Anyway, thank you very much for the invitation to speak to you. I studied in London for a year, but it was a much older London then. And it's changed so much, and it was a wonderful invitation to come over here. My wife and I enjoyed it very much. Thank you very, very much.